Pixie, and everyone that's been on the show. Get out to the theatre.
But through it all, when there was doubt, I ate it up and spit it out. I faced it all and I stood tall and did it my way.
Yes. We are back at Film Fight Club for a summer special, doing it our way.
Yes, this is Virat Nehru.
And this is Chris Evans. Our regular host, Glenn Falkenstein, is away, and so the mice will play.
Yes, that's really good, actually, yeah. Congratulations, Chris. I'm very impressed by your rhyming skills.
Thank you, thank you. It's Mutual Appreciation Society, formerly known as Film Fight Club.
Yes, the Lynch and Malick fans have reunited.
Yes, that's
in
right.
In this very special episode, without Glenn, because we're doing it our way.
I'll try to work in some Lynch and Malick references. I almost forgot. Thank you for the pre-reminder.
I mean, will it be a Film Fight Club episode without Lynch and Malick?
Yeah.
Our patron god, the cinephiles.
That's right. We're doing a summer special episode where we'll talk about some of the significant films that have been released over the summer, but not all of them, because Film Fight Club has never been completionist and isn't going to start now.
Okay, we'll be talking about Glass, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, Aquaman, Vice, and The Favourite.
How's your summer been going?
Yeah, it's pretty hot out here, to be honest. I don't know which part of the world you guys are, but if you're in Australia or Sydney or one of those places,
Heatwave.
Yeah, pretty hot, but not in a good way.
Victoria is pretty hot at the moment as well.
Yeah, well, I'm going to the Aussie Open for tennis. So I'm going to see my one true love, Roger Federer.
Funny you say that. I'm going to my one true love, Rainbow Serpent, in Victoria. So we'll have to meet next week, and maybe some of our ramblings will make it into a future episode.
Yeah, well, you know, in the good times, I think both of our one true loves could coexist.
That's true.
I would love to see Roger Federer at Rainbow Serpent one year.
That could be
one of the cool dads.
Yeah.
You know, like 20 years from now or something. You could be one of those things like, man, fame doesn't matter.
Right,
you know,
right.
What is even being famous?
You know,
I did everything.
All that really matters
everything.
Is this moment, right
exactly,
now.
Exactly, right now.
Yeah.
Who am I? Am I even Roger Federer? Am I just some dude talking to some other dude about some things?
Mm.
Yeah.
Speaking of dudes talking to dudes about things, we saw the big new release of the week, Glass. It's full of dudes talking to dudes. If we're using dudes in the gender neutral sense, because often it's a woman doing the talking.
Yeah. Well, you're right.
Anyway, dudes talk to dudes about stuff in the new film from M. Night Shyamalan.
Bruce Willis is dead. Bruce Willis is dead. Bruce Willis is dead.
So, once again, reuniting with Bruce Willis of The Sixth Sense and Unbreakable fame. He doesn't play a ghost in this one. Oh, we broke another Film Fight Club rule for no spoilers. Sorry, dude. Sorry, Glenn.
But yeah, honestly, The Sixth Sense, that was the least impressive part about that movie. Yeah, Bruce Willis is dead. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, well, M. Night Shyamalan is prone to...
But it's not that great a twist, is it? Like, you know, he's just been dead. You just see ghosts. You know, just get on with it.
Yeah, the M. Night Shyamalan, all the hype around him is about his twists, but often they...
They're pretty lame.
Usually they're pretty lame.
Also, like, actually, there's so much more interesting stuff going around his actual filmmaking rather than the twist.
Yeah.
I don't even watch his movies for the plot. The plots are the least interesting thing about his style of filmmaking. That goes for the same with Glass, which also has a pretty lame twist.
Yeah. So for those playing at home, Glass is the sequel to Unbreakable and also to the stealth continuation of the Unbreakable universe, Split. Once more, M. Night Shyamalan is back with a very abstract, unusual... I don't know if abstract is the right way to put it, actually, because it explains things a lot.
It does. I mean, there's a lot of exposition about exposition. And this is sort of deep monologues about what it means to be a superhero, what it means to be a hero, are comic book people real?
That's
you
right.
Know? But it's also incredibly self-serious, but also goofy.
Yeah, goofy is the word. It's a very strange mix. Basically, this film catches up with the reluctant superhero and unbreakable David Dunn, who is now...
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, 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 indeed. I like how he was given a nice comic booky name. You know, two of the same, you know, first name, last name, Peter Parker.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, that's
Clark Kent.
Didn't even
same
hit
sound.
Me until you just pointed out. Easter eggs.
Right. He is now stalking around Philadelphia neighborhoods, fighting crime, and he's on the case of the Horde, the split personality killer played by James McAvoy.
He's so good. I mean,
he's amazing in this
movie. I sometimes feel James McAvoy doesn't deserve to be in this universe because
he elevates the film, but I think Shyamalan meets him because the filmmaking around his character is actually M. Night Shyamalan at his best. So I wonder if this is just a magic collaboration.
Because actually the physicality of James McAvoy's sort of presence and what he can do and bring to these characters actually comes about because of how Shyamalan is doing his camera positioning. And, you know, there are some very interesting jump scares that happen because of how Shyamalan has positioned the camera.
Well, there's a really interesting way that Shyamalan frames the Horde, James McAvoy, switching between his personalities in one shot with a camera moving over between somebody lecturing him. And then each time the camera pans back, it's a different personality that we're seeing from James McAvoy.
It's very neat filmmaking. And also, like, something you're probably taught in film school, but you kind of forget the bigger you become. Because sometimes the basic things kind of actually work better.
Shyamalan is getting a lot of hate for this film. I feel like we're going to be some of the few to give this a positive review.
Let's go through the plot first, because before we come to the sort of exposition part, we actually like this movie, and I know we're going to have to justify it quite a bit, why we liked it.
Film Fight Club is back with the hottest
contrarian.
Takes.
Very contrarian.
Very contrarian episode coming up.
I was surprised because I went in to hate this movie. And I was ready to hate this. Yeah. But also,
there's so much negativity about this film right now on the internet and the critical discourse.
Like,
if we
take away Split and people who were reintroduced to this universe through Split and not through, you know, Unbreakable, this is closer in tone to Unbreakable in a very grounded sensibility than Split.
I think so.
I think Split is this kind of outlier which raised people's expectations about the superhero genre.
Yeah.
But this movie is a sibling to Unbreakable in how the tone is set.
That's right, because I think people were expecting a big superhero throwdown because that's what the ending of Split seems to suggest. We've built up this big villain and, oh my God, the grand hero, what's he been like in the last 20 years?
And Shyamalan is clever enough to take the mickey out of that because he keeps referring to the showdown this entire movie, but which is pretty funny.
That's right. I think a big focus of this film is about swerving from expectations. Everything is smaller scale than you might imagine, and whenever something large scale is built up, it doesn't happen. Meanwhile, we have Samuel L. Jackson reprising his role from Unbreakable, Mr. Glass.
Very breakable, very fragile.
Very, very fragile. The title character of this film, the comic book super nerd, giving commentary explaining how the smaller scale skirmishes we're witnessing are actually, this is the final showdown, this is the big climax. And a lot of people are saying this is showing Shyamalan's two up his own ass and it's all self-serious. I actually think this movie's very self-aware and scenes like that show it. Like, the, you know, grand music playing while people have a fight in a parking lot.
Yeah. And, oh, God.
It's
also
goofy as hell. And
dramatic
Sam Jackson
confrontation scenes are shot in a way that make them more grand than they actually are. Look about it, these are two very old dudes trying very hard to be
there's
a lot of physical comedy going on, but not actual grandiose histrionics.
Yeah. I feel like Shyamalan actually does know what he's doing with the contrast between the small scale and the grand scale of, you know, the music and the framing. That there's a level of self-awareness of the absurdity and the goofiness of comic book movies. I think a lot of people are missing this because it doesn't come with the kind of ironic winking, which movies, for example, always, if ever they try to show their self-awareness, it's in the way of, you know, deprecating themselves and flattering the audience.
Yeah.
Whereas this film, I think, is actually, though it's aware of how ridiculous it is, very, very sincere.
It's very sincere, but also it's making fun of both. It's making fun of its own genre, its own sort of roots, and also the audience for its expectations.
Yeah.
So in a way, Shyamalan is giving the bird to his own film, and also the audience were expecting a certain kind of film from him.
Yeah, that's
which
right.
Which is, I think,
it's a total swerve.
Because some people usually think that Shyamalan is too smart for his own good.
Mm.
Like, you know, that's not a trait in filmmakers that you should admire.
Right.
I'm not sure where I sit on that, but I can see if people would argue from that perspective that he's being deliberately a kind of a a-hole,
right,
then yeah, sure.
When you were bringing up before the fight scenes, I've seen people complaining, I shouldn't be spending so much time reviewing the other reviewers on this movie, but here I go. I've seen people complaining about the fight scene, saying they're awkward and strange, but to me that was what made them great. As you mentioned before, Virat, that we're just watching a bunch of like middle-aged men grunting at each other.
But hilarious.
That's what they are. But that's
very
what,
laugh-out-loud moments, and I was laughing quite loudly.
Me too. But at the same time, I was getting G'd up. You know, I was getting into it.
Yeah.
The action scenes are, you know, men running at each other, sort of wrestling and gripping each other and banging into things, which is what...
Yeah.
A real-life fight between two burly titans would be like.
Exactly. But also, like, if you think about it, if you think about the scope and the location of this movie and how it doesn't change with the minority of it, these are just two people confined in a space, and then all they do is get out to a park or a garden.
Yeah.
They don't really go anywhere.
Exactly, yeah.
But
it's epic.
But it's epic because you made it out to the garden. You know? It's like, okay, I just took a walk. Yeah,
I made
cool.
it to the garden. Yeah. Most of the movie is confined to one location, and most of the film is conversations. The plot is really, it seems like it's going to go into some sort of Shyamalan mega twist territory where is this a psychological thriller where we start to question whether anything in the previous films was real or whether it all just existed in the characters' minds. And I actually found some of this stuff really interesting, or at least the feeling that the rug might be pulled from under me at any moment.
But also, that would be a very interesting film about mental health, actually.
The film could have been more interesting than it was.
You know, if we were to embrace the mental health aspect and see where that would have taken
it. I actually wish the film had gone further in that direction, because I think there are ways that it could have been true to its themes, the same themes that come out in the actual trajectory of the film, without pulling us in. I think, look, the ending is one of the weak points. It's too sudden. There's a massive late-stage Shyamalan twist, which isn't explored enough. It
true.
Comes too late in the film to really resonate. And I think,
I don't think this film needed a twist, to be honest.
No, I don't think
so. I mean, the actual backbone of this movie is about what it's trying to communicate
That's
through
right.
its themes.
I wish it had just stuck to the direction it was going and brought those themes
because
to the
final,
natural conclusion.
The final scene was actually poignant for me. And, you know, when that happened and how it's filmed. So without the twist, I actually would have bought the sincerity of it.
Yeah.
And the twist is actually the unnecessary.
Right. The weak point of M. Night Shyamalan, I think, has always been his writing, and more specifically his dialogue, which is terrible. And this is a film full of speechifying. I think it's only the goofiness of it that stops me from hating.
Oh, totally. I mean,
the dialogue is terrible.
Especially, you know, the Sarah Paulson's character, which is playing a psychiatrist. This is some of the worst psychiatrist dialogue writing I've seen.
Her acting is really too much. The character is too much of like a type as opposed to a person.
I would have loved somebody like Jodie Foster playing it or something.
That would have been great.
I was just thinking, you know, very Silence of the Lambs, very sort of poker faced would have been much more interesting. I think she kind of made it too obvious.
Yeah. I think if we had seen the film that other critics seem to have seen, then the psychologist character would have just like absolutely killed the film.
Sure.
But I think that there's the realization of this is so ridiculous while you're having arguments about comic book minutiae.
Exactly. But also
details
the fact
and
that
plot arcs between a psychologist and superheroes. And I'm thinking, okay, this is absurd. And
just the fact that it's talking about something called the superhero delusion from comic books. It signposts its ridiculousness quite in the beginning.
Yeah, I think so,
too. If you're not buying into that universe, then this movie is not for you.
Yeah.
Like, you're not looking for some kind of diagnostic manual for level arguments about which kind of mental disorder we're talking about. Nah, it's pretty basic. It's pretty...
It's not that deep.
Yeah.
It's not deep at all.
But part of the fun, like you mentioned, Shyamalan does incredibly well is that the speechifying works to set up these sort of visual cues that work really well for the film.
Yeah, that's right.
For example, the music cues that build up for, you know, this show about very sincere moments about payoffs or about being superheroes. And
I just want to give praise to Shyamalan's visual sense, which I think has developed a long way from his earlier films. I think it's really strong right now. This is really playfully shot. Going back to the fight scenes we're talking about earlier, it's like POV, you know, Snorricam, as Darren Aronofsky, I think, called it, where there's a camera right in the person's face as they're being gripped from behind and twirled around.
But even Glass's first reveal is a POV shot.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is also
really interesting off-center camera moves. The aforementioned scene where the camera's panning between the Horde and Sarah Paulson's psychologist.
Yeah. But also how each character is looked at.
Yeah,
for example, the point of view shot where Sarah Paulson's character is tilting her head to look at glass, and that was a very interesting off-center shot.
That's right, and there's an amazing Hitchcockian zoom in this stare-down moment between Bruce Willis, which is hilarious. I think that the playfulness comes through and was making me laugh.
Which also kind of makes me sad, because what are we expecting from superhero movies now? You know, are we expecting the big spectacle, or are we expecting interesting filmmaking?
Yeah, which is an interesting dynamic. For me, this is interesting filmmaking. Yeah. And it's especially interesting because we live in a superhero movie saturated time. People have said, what's the point of this down-to-earth superhero movie in a time when superheroes are a dime a dozen and we are always seeing different versions of it? But I think now is the perfect time for a movie like Unbreakable to come back, because it just sticks a pin into the enormous balloon of superhero world building.
DC has been trying to do this, right, for eternity.
But this is much more successful than the Justice League.
Not in that sense.
Superman.
Yeah, yeah, but DC in that sense about trying to make movies about what it means to be a superhero.
It's gritty.
You know, this kind of philosophical diatribes. But this movie, in its speechifying or whatever, we call them flaws, but they actually contribute to very much sincerity of it, which that lacks.
The speechifying about what it means to be a superhero midway through the movie was actually starting to get to me, and I was finding it quite poignant. It was getting at like what is inspiring about superhero archetypes and the essence of what makes them great, and the idea of believing in something, which is the appeal of comic books.
And also, I
loved that.
Throwaway scenes about this neon with, you know, in
heroes,
the bookstore.
Villains.
Hero and villains. A character goes in the bookstore looking for comic books, and he's looking in the heroes aisle, and you have a heroes neon sign, but he's like, oh, I haven't found the right character, and pop, right behind him, it's a villains aisle, and that's when he had the brainwave. Maybe I've been looking in the wrong aisle all along. I should be looking in the villains aisle.
There's a hilarious scene of looking through the comic books to find out that
there's a parallel to
a man beast character exists, and it's accompanied by huge music on the soundtrack. And
but
it's
also like incredible,
that
sort of like,
I don't know.
But also
the whole movie is like making the mundane into the epic, but simultaneously
I love that shot because, you know, it was a back and forth, and each time you zooming into the comic book panel even more and more and more and more. So it just felt like, you know, that kind of the meme shot where you just keep zooming in. And you're like, oh my God, a big reveal. But it's not really.
It's not that big of a reveal.
It's not really. All right. But that's the fun part of it.
All right. So it's no big deal.
Bruce Willis is dead.
That's just Shyamalan's style. He sometimes blows things up when it's like, all right.
But that's the thing. I'm really happy that he's aware of that. He's aware of his
embracing. Seems to be becoming more self-aware.
And this Blumhouse and Shyamalan kind of co-production would be an interesting thing.
I think it's a good collaboration. They've worked together on his last three films, which have, in my opinion, have really brought him back. I think Shyamalan had become a laughingstock, and I think I don't care what other people think about Glass. I think he's back. He's back to making interesting, fascinatingly weird, clumsy.
Because even when he
films
was like
doing what anyone else is doing, genuinely original.
Even when he was making bad movies, he was still making them bad for spectacularly original reasons.
That's right.
Like, you know,
I think we need M. Night Shyamalan more than ever in the current Hollywood
big budget
blockbuster landscape.
A correlative Lady in the Water companion piece that I can say. Yeah, I know, but it's such an originally bad film.
It is,
I cannot point out same mistakes.
Only a really talented person could make a film.
Such a bad film.
Yeah, that's right.
Which has, like, such trademark Shyamalan badness.
Yes.
Which is just like, you know, only you can think of
that. Be bad in this way.
Exactly. But it's also, did it my way.
Yeah.
Literally, you know, he makes bad films his own way.
He does, yeah.
I do agree with that. And that's something really endearing about that. Yeah, I think we're losing that in this kind of whatever, this hyper fast
paced universe.
This
is a film that was made with zero input of the studios almost. Shyamalan put in a lot of his own money to guarantee creative control. And God bless him, because no one else is making this kind of weirdness.
It requires patience to.
It does. That's true.
And that's something very interesting, because
it's
all about the build-up.
It's the trend.
It's all about the build-up.
Yes. He's always been that way. And I am really thankful that he's sticking with that in a time when we're moving more and more into instant gratification.
And I think what I've heard, what I've read, is that most people are disappointed that it doesn't even have a payoff.
Yeah.
It's interesting how the film is about something else entirely. And
It's about something you find along the way. Yeah, but I can see people feeling cheated if they think it's going to be about what.
But maybe that's more
really
common about our expectations from superhero movies.
That's true. Yeah,
like
and the film's
generically
about,
fed.
It's all about trying to present something different using superheroes, something completely different to what else is out there, and people are going to go in expecting what the convention dictates and
you know, this isn't that. That's Glass. We hope you like it. And, you know, it needs more fans.
Just go in with lesser...
Go in ready for anything, notions. I yeah. think. Yeah. Go in and, ready and for some strange time. Directions. So,
Have fun.
On the subject of the superhero glut, I didn't see it, but what did you think of Aquaman?
Okay, Aquaman. Oh, wow. This is an interesting segue from, like, Glass, which is very grounded,
yep.
to Aquaman, which is completely over the top. It's made a lot of money. Gosh.
It did make a lot of
but
money.
But that hasn't stopped us from completely pooing over some films.
Yep.
So we're going to do it again. Mm. Here we are. Okay, Aquaman is a fun DC movie.
Yep.
That's all. I mean, that's all it's had going for it.
All right, so that was Aquaman.
The thing is, like, and I'm saying that as a disclaimer because...
DC's not usually fun.
I think they're just so self-serious.
Yeah.
Aquaman is the first time where they really thought, what would it be like if our characters could actually have fun? Jason Momoa's character and his actual personality off-screen does a lot to feed into that. I think because he's someone who just oozes a lot of charisma.
Hmm.
And this kind of very playful larrikin. He's basically a Thor replacement.
Seems like to Marvel's me to be Thor. Going for that like quippy,
yeah.
you know, bro, do, whoa.
But also, I think with Momoa, comedy. What the interesting thing is, his dialogue delivery is barely understandable. So you're not actually... yeah, yeah. The good thing about that is he gets to do a lot more physical comedy. Chris Hemsworth, I feel, has become a revelation in the comedic space. More than the action space. So I think he should be more explored as a comedic actor. Jason Momoa.
Okay.
I think these kind of very physically bulky dudes are actually so self-aware of their physical sort of, you know, imperviousness and how they physically intimidate people that they can use that to advantage on screen.
Right.
And actually, you know, do some interesting physical comedy. That's probably the most interesting thing about Aquaman, where they're using a very physically intimidating character to basically make fun of that,
right.
is sort of physical intimidation and how basically how much of a, you know, tank top dude he looks like.
Dude bro.
Yeah. So in that sense, about masculinity and what it takes to be, you know, a self-aware man in the 21st century and have the mantle of a superhero, I think it's got a very interesting subversive commentary. I'm very thankful that this didn't go the DC way of, you know, does it mean to be a superhero? Am I ready for being a superhero? This kind of stuff.
It's more of just a surface level, like, sincere superhero narrative.
Sincere. And also, James Wan, I got to give him credit. His underwater world building is actually interesting.
Yeah, how's the action? I've heard it's pretty big scale.
It's very big scale. And also, there's, you know, incredibly well lit, which is good. Not dark DC film. It's not like everything is happening at night.
Bright, colorful, Avatar-esque?
Yeah, not as much. Still the sepia-toned kind of feel to it, unfortunately. Okay. But, like, it's got, you know, the spectacle element to it.
Mm.
It really is takes the time to show you parts of the world, and not everything is building up to an action set piece.
Right.
It still has this, you know, the usual beat of an action film that it has to go through, but it's still taking time to actually, you know, but here's a cutaway shot to something interesting, which is part of this world, which you're not going to see again. But, you know, it adds to the whatever interesting thing for the world. And it's a quest story, you know.
Yeah.
The hero has to go through. It's essentially The Lion King. That's what
okay,
I'm trying to say.
Right. So is Black Panther.
Essentially, it is Black Panther. It is the same template.
Thank God we have someone like M. Night Shyamalan to bust this template
but
open,
right? The reluctant son of, you know, a kingdom isn't sure whether he's ready to take over, has to find his half-brother, Orm, essentially, for the throne. It's Black Panther. It's basically DC's Black Panther.
Okay.
But fun.
So continuing...
Also, Amber Heard, actually. The female characters are the more interesting ones in this one, which have more to do...
Same is true of Black Panther.
And here, especially Amber Heard's character is playing... You know, Mira saves the life of Aquaman, Arthur Curry, quite a few times, and she gets nothing in return. So she gets a pretty raw deal, to be honest. But, you know, all she has to do is then romance, Jason Momoa, which I guess in some cases you can call that a pretty good deal from where you're looking at it. But like, as a character, he's not really that interesting. He's just, like, a very thick blockhead.
Right.
And then you're like, okay, cool. But like,
just like Thor.
Yeah, so it's Nicole Kidman who plays his mother, and Amber Heard who plays his love interest, get a lot more to do, and it's not very interesting. William Dafoe is interesting as well. So yeah, all dudes around him, pretty cool. Women around him, pretty cool. Him, not so much. But he's hot.
God, it sounds exactly the same as Black Panther in ways. Yeah. So continuing the superhero trend, it's still around in cinemas. Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. What do we think?
Oh, my God. I loved it.
Yeah.
It's the best Spider-Man movie since my very first Spider-Man experience.
Right. I think, personally, I still prefer Spider-Man 2.
Yeah.
But only just. For me, these films are pretty much evenly matched. And for me, that puts them right at the top of the superhero genre. Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse is a CG animated Spider-Man movie about Miles Morales taking up the mantle of Spider-Man after learning about the existence of multiple dimensions and the ability for there to be multiple different Spider-Men. It's an unusual take, but the meta-ness I felt was interesting because it's honest to the way that we engage with these characters these days. I mean, it's very much a film for our time. I think it's hard for people to just watch the standard
origin
superhero
story template. Yeah.
That's right. The standard, you know, the innocent young boy becomes super strong superhero thing when we're seeing it all the time in so many different variations. So I think there's something honest about meeting the audience's expectations to say, yes, this character exists in many different guises. Superheroes aren't that special. They're actually all out there just beyond the veil that the characters in the film can't see. The opening sequence brings in memes about Spider-Man that exist in a flatter to the audience and say, this is Spider-Man, and show him as a comic book character.
Which also kind of like made me realize that maybe the best medium for superhero and comic movies are still
cartoons.
Animation.
Absolutely.
And there's so much more inventiveness that you can actually put in.
Yeah.
The actual comic book feel to it, you know, the closest we've come to that in the real world is Scott Pilgrim, essentially.
Yeah.
But still, like, well, this had a lot of... And
The Japanese, you know, almost all their animation industry comes from animating the massive comic book surplus. And this film, I think, actually borrows a lot from the Japanese approach.
It does.
There's some...
Well, it has a Japanese...
character in it, yeah. Nice tip of the hat. A Japanese Spider-Man.
And without it being, you know, completely racist or xenophobic, which also I appreciate it, because usually when you go different culture, unfortunately, it doesn't have a good track record.
Yeah, this was respectful. This is probably the most visually inventive Hollywood film of the year. 2018. There's some really striking compositions. I found it interesting that the animation style is this kind of, again, anime-esque staccato style, where instead of it being in fluid 24 frames per second, they've done what what Japanese animators often do, which is animate less frames but make more interesting and dynamic frames.
Yeah. And each frame is leading into different styles which you wouldn't expect. You would like, you would, because you know how our brains work, that we preempt the next shot.
Yeah.
Like, I've heard this, like, I've seen this much, and then your brain starts forming the next scene.
That's the art of animation.
Exactly, and it's all about predicting, and they usually, what this film does really well is that it just plays with that expectation.
Yeah, because
a lot of those scenes where you think that, oh, this is now going to be the next shot. Nope, it's like something else happens.
Comic book and anime-esque effects where suddenly the frame comes alive with color.
Yeah.
You know, like the background that has been replaced by speed lines.
I was thinking a lot about Night of Short Walk on Girl when I was watching this.
Right.
Masaki because Yuasa, I was getting a lot of that, especially how, you know, you have these quick cutaways about, you know, expectations versus what actually happens. And that plays around with your visual narrative in the bicycle scenes in Night of Short Walk on Girl.
Right.
And, you know, you have this sort of very fast thing and, you know, he's sort of dodging a lot of things. And that's how the spider sling scenes are done as well. The point of view shots in Spider-Man, especially, which is most fun to do in any Spider-Man movie, because, you know, he's just literally flying across the city, are also really interesting because you get to see him stumble in ways
so
that
are,
yeah,
so
very,
kinetic.
Very dynamic. It's a first-person kind of feel
of
to it.
This is one of the few Hollywood films in recent times, Glass would be another, that I feel is actually trying to do interesting, different things with the camera. You know, I feel like trying to surprise people in the way and trying to film things in different ways seems to be
a lot of the times
going away.
A lot of the times I did feel I was, you know, watching a first-person kind of film where I Spider-Man, and it was seen from that perspective.
And the way that the multi-dimensional stuff was depicted was really eye-popping out there.
The noir Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. It's great. But also, like, that was almost occupying a part of the frame where the colors were totally, like, you know, deliberately different from the rest of the frame.
So much visual creativity. Going back to the story of it, I found that...
It has a story as well, guys.
It does have a story. It's not just a visual experience.
Malik sort of intuition got away from us. It does have a story. It's a proper, you know, narrative film. Don't worry about it. You know, they have the plot and everything else.
All those things. Yeah, this film made me care about some of the aspects of the Spider-Man origin story that are, you know, completely played out. That, you know, the Andrew Garfield movies, for example, when they rehash these elements, I just thought, I do not give a shit. Whereas in Into the Spider-Verse, they've found ways to refresh, play with the scale of how we perceive Spider-Man with Miles Morales and the stakes up against him and his place in the world, so that the usual beats of his origin story really hit hard and feel fresh. They've found ways to surprise you.
I mean, even the alternate universe of Peter Parker and what he was going through. That was a very interesting sort of take of, like, what would Peter Parker be in his midlife crisis?
Yeah, and it's interesting. This movie brings in a lot of aspects of the Spider-Man character that have been in the comics but haven't really been in the films before, because before the... Spider-Man as an adult struggling with his relationship with Mary Jane and trying to be a good guy is a thing that's been in the comics, but the films have always avoided it. But now that they have the freedom not just to keep Peter Parker as a relatable to the young audience teenage character by introducing this multi-dimensional thing, we're able to have that in Miles Morales and then see
But even...